All right, let's dive into another one of these deep dives.
Yeah.
Today we're going to be talking about a case that's pretty intense, especially for anybody out there working in community corrections.
Yeah, definitely a case with some serious implications.
Exactly. So we're looking at a 1991 Virginia Supreme Court case, Dudley v. Offender Aid and Restoration OAR for short.
Right.
And this whole thing revolves around this question of how liable are halfway houses when one of their residents commits a crime? It's a question a lot of people were asking after this whole thing went down.
Absolutely. And this case really set a precedent. You know, it had ripple effect across the whole system.
Okay. So let's get into the nitty-gritty here.
Okay.
We've got Timothy Spencer, who's a convicted violent felon.
Right.
And then we've got Debbie Davis, who is tragically the victim in all this.
Yes.
Can you kind of take us back to the beginning and paint a picture of what led up to this whole legal battle?
Sure. So Spencer, you know, he had a history of violence actually going all the way back to his childhood.
Right.
He was serving time and he was considered high risk. Like, he was actually denied parole a couple of times.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah.
But somehow he ends up at this halfway house run by Offender Aid and Restoration.
Okay.
And their security, let's just say it was lacking.
Oh, no.
I mean, we're talking about filthy conditions, barely any supervision alarms you could practically disable with a sneeze.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a mess.
It sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It was. And tragically, that's exactly what it became. Yeah. Spencer, he just walked right out of that halfway house and committed a horrific crime. He murdered Debbie Davis.
Oh, that's just awful. It's just heartbreaking. And I imagine that's when everybody started asking,
right,
could this have been prevented? Could OAR have done something, anything to stop this?
Exactly. That question is at the heart of the legal battle that follows.
So the victim's family, they sue OAR. What was their legal strategy here?
So the plaintiff argued that OAR was negligent in how they supervised Spencer. And they invoked a really important legal principle that might sound familiar to some of you listening. It's the idea that if you're in charge of someone that you know is likely to cause harm, you have a duty to take reasonable steps to control them to prevent that harm.
Makes sense.
And in legalese, we call this restatement Second of Torts, Section 319.
Okay, so basically they're saying you knew he was dangerous, you were in charge of him, and you just didn't do enough.
Exactly. And there's another layer to this. Remember, OAR actually had a contract with the Department of Corrections to supervise Spencer.
Ah, so it wasn't just a loose agreement. They had a formal contract.
Right. This contract becomes a key piece of evidence in the case.
So what were the specifics of that contract? What exactly was OAR supposed to be doing?
Well, the contract laid out some pretty specific requirements like bed checks, curfews, reporting any absence immediately.
Oh, wow. So the whole nine yards.
But here's the kicker. OAR wasn't exactly following the rule book.
Wait, so they weren't even doing the bare minimum? Oh, man. This is starting to look really bad for them.
Yeah.
But I'm sure OAR had some kind of defense, right?
Oh, they absolutely did. They fought back hard. They claimed they weren't technically Spencer's legal custodians, you know, in the same way a prison would be.
Right.
They tried to argue that their responsibility was limited.
So it becomes this question of how much control did they actually have and how much responsibility comes with that control?
Precisely. And this is where the court had to get into some really fine legal distinctions.
Okay.
You see, this wasn't about a parole out on their own.
Right.
Spencer was still actively serving his sentence.
So he was still in the system.
Exactly.
And they agreed to supervise him within the system.
Exactly. And that's a crucial point. The plaintiff was basically saying, hey, you signed a contract to supervise him within the system, and that means you had real custody, not just some casual agreement.
Right. So that contract really comes back to bite them. But how did the court actually use this to determine liability? What was their reasoning?
Well, the court looked at a previous case, Fox v. Custis, which involved a parolee, not someone actively serving their sentence like Spencer. They used this distinction to establish that because Spencer was still under the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, OAR's contract with them gave them what they called contractual custody.
Interesting. So that contract was the linchpin?
It was.
Okay. So that's one point for the plaintiff.
Yeah.
What else did the court consider?
Well, they also looked at Spencer's history. Remember, we talked about his long history of violence?
Right, from childhood.
This wasn't some guy with a minor offense.
Yeah.
OAR knew he was dangerous. They knew his tendencies.
So they were fully aware of the risk.
Yes. And the court was basically saying, you knew this guy was a powder keg and you treated him like any other resident.
Yeah, given the lax security we talked about, that seems incredibly negligent.
It was. And the court didn't let them off easy. They went on to say that Debbie Davis's death was a direct result of OAR's failure to fulfill their contractual obligations.
Yeah.
In legal terms, this is known as proximate cause.
So they drew a direct line between OAR's negligence and this horrific outcome.
Exactly. They established that if OAR had done what they were supposed to do, Debbie Davis might still be alive.
Wow. That's a powerful statement. But I bet OAR didn't just roll over and accept this. They probably had some more arguments up their sleeve.
Oh, you bet. They tried to claim immunity from liability. They pointed to a case, Marshall v. Winston, which involved public officials.
So they were trying to use that case to say, hey, we're practically an arm of the government, so we should have the same protections.
Exactly. But the court quickly shut that down. They said, nope, OAR, you are a private organization, not a government agency. You don't get that same immunity.
So the court drew a clear line. Private companies can't just hide behind the shield of government immunity.
Nope. They're held to a different standard.
That's a big deal. It's like they're saying, if you want to take on this responsibility of managing these individuals, you better be prepared to do it right. No cutting corners.
Exactly. And in making that distinction, the court was really prioritizing public safety over any convenience for private companies.
It's a strong message for sure. So what did this decision actually mean for halfway houses and reentry programs in the long run?
Well, this case, you see, sent shockwaves through the entire reentry system.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
It's like the whole system had to take a hard look in the mirror.
Yeah, it was a real turning point. You know, before Dudley, a lot of these programs were operating with this kind of optimistic view of reintegration.
Right.
Maybe a little naive about the risks.
Yeah.
But this case forced them to wake up and smell the coffee.
So it became less about second chances and more about understanding who was getting that second chance and what kind of dangers they might pose.
Exactly. It was about protecting the community while still helping people get back on their feet.
Right. That balance is so important. So it sounds like this case led to some major overhauls in their procedures.
Oh, yeah. Dudley basically mandated a much more rigorous approach to risk assessment.
Makes sense.
It became standard practice to really evaluate each offender, looking at their criminal history, psychological profile, everything.
So no more one-size-fits-all approach?
Nope. It was about individualized decisions based on the specific risk factors of each person.
So you're really acknowledging that reentry isn't just about opening the door and crossing your fingers.
Right. You have to provide the right support and structure for someone to truly reintegrate.
So that's a huge shift. But I bet that's not all. What about security protocols? I mean, given what happened to Debbie Davis, you'd think they'd have to step up their game.
You bet they did. Remember that practically non-existent security we talked about?
Yeah, it was pretty shocking.
Well, Dudley put an end to that. Security became priority number one.
So what did that look like in practice? What kind of changes did they actually make?
Well, for starters, no more disappearing acts like Timothy Spencer's.
Yeah.
Facilities started implementing strict check-in and check-out procedures, along with regular bed checks curfews. They were finally taking monitoring seriously.
Seems like common sense. But before Dudley, a lot of places weren't even doing the basics.
It's sad, but true. But it wasn't just about procedures. They made big upgrades to physical security, too.
Like, what kind of upgrades are we talking
about? Well, you know, things like reinforced doors and windows, better lighting, more advanced alarm systems. They basically closed all the loopholes.
Smart. It sounds like they were really trying to cover all their bases. But even with the best security systems, you still need people to operate them right.
Absolutely. You're right on the money with that. Staff training became a huge focus after Dudley.
So they weren't just throwing bodies at the problem. They were actually training them to do the job, right?
Exactly. Employees were trained to recognize warning signs, de-escalate situations, respond quickly to any security breaches. They became active participants in the reentry process.
It's a good reminder that human judgment is still so important. Technology can only take you so far.
I couldn't agree more. But let's be real. All of these changes, risk assessments, security upgrades, staff training, it all costs money.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So how did the industry adapt to this new reality? Did everyone just fall in line after Dudley?
Well, it wasn't a flip of a switch. Some programs were definitely quicker to adapt than others, but the message from the courts was clear. Public safety is paramount.
Right.
And, you know, the threat of liability was a powerful motivator.
I bet. Nobody wants to get sued.
Exactly. Nobody wanted to be the next OAR facing a lawsuit and potentially huge financial consequences.
So Dudley didn't just change the rules. It changed the whole risk calculation for these organizations.
Precisely. They were forced to take responsibility in a way they hadn't before.
But do you think it was all about avoiding lawsuits, or did some organizations genuinely see the value in these changes?
I think it was probably a mix of both. At first, a lot of organizations probably saw it as a burden.
Right. More work, more expenses.
Exactly. But over time, I think many started to see the benefits. After all, a safer facility is a more effective facility.
Sure.
And a successful reentry program is good for everyone, the individual, the community, society as a whole.
It's a win-win. So in a way, Dudley forced the whole system to mature, to become more professional, more accountable.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can't forget the tragedy that led to these changes, but I think it's also important to recognize the positive impact Dudley had on the field.
I agree.
It shifted the focus from warehousing people to actually preparing them for life outside.
Which is ultimately the goal.
Right, exactly. But even with all these improvements, we gotta be realistic. Reentry is tough. There are no guarantees.
Of course, people make mistakes. Even after they've served their time.
That's right. Even with all the risk assessments and security measures, we can't predict human behavior perfectly.
Right. So Dudley raised the bar, but it didn't magically solve every problem.
Nope. We still have work to do. And this case is a constant reminder of that balance we need to strike.
That balance between individual rights and public safety, between accountability and redemption.
Exactly. And Dudley v. OAR will continue to shape that conversation for a long time to come.
It's a case that really gets you thinking. Makes you question a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I think that's the sign of a truly important legal decision.
I agree. It sticks with you.
It does. So what kind of lasting impact did Dudley have on the legal landscape? How did it change the way lawyers approach these kinds of cases?
Well, this case really changed the game, especially when it came to the whole concept of duty. Before Dudley, you practically needed like a signed confession or something to prove a facility had a responsibility to prevent harm.
It sounds like plaintiffs had a really high bar to clear.
Yeah, you had to show that they knew about a very specific danger, almost like they had a crystal ball or something.
Right, like they should have seen it coming.
Exactly. But Dudley really broadened the scope of responsibility.
So how did that work?
Well, now you could argue that a duty existed even without a specific threat, as long as the offender's general dangerousness was known.
So basically, if they knew or should have known that someone was dangerous, they were liable.
Right. No more excuses, no more hiding behind a lack of a specific threat.
It sounds like that would have been a huge relief for victims and their families.
Oh, absolutely. Dudley really empowered them to hold these organizations accountable.
It's amazing how a single case can have such a ripple effect.
It really is. It shows how the law can evolve to meet changing needs.
But you mentioned earlier there's a caveat to this whole duty thing. What were the limits of the responsibility that Dudley established?
Ah, yes. The court made it clear that the duty to control only extends to victims who are geographically proximate to the offender.
Okay, so what does that mean exactly? Geographically proximate.
Well, that's where things get a little murky. It's not always clear cut.
So give me an example. Let's say an offender escapes from a halfway house in Virginia and then commits a crime in California. Would the halfway house be off the hook?
That's the million-dollar question. And to be honest, it depends on the specific circumstances. Dudley left a lot of room for interpretation on this point.
So it becomes a question of foreseeability. Mm-hmm. Could the halfway house have reasonably foreseen that this person might escape and commit a crime on the other side of the country?
Exactly. And that's a tough one to answer. It's been debated in legal circles ever since.
It sounds like a lawyer's dream, or maybe their nightmare, depending on which side of the case they're on.
It definitely adds another layer of complexity.
It's a reminder that these legal precedents are rarely black and white.
You got it. It's always room for interpretation, and that's what keeps things interesting.
That's why we love the law, right? Mm. So to wrap this up, what's the key takeaway for our listeners? What's the one thing they should remember from Dudley v. OAR?
I think the biggest takeaway is that Dudley was a major wake-up call for the whole community corrections field. It established that contractual control comes with a serious responsibility to protect the public.
So halfway houses can't just be revolving doors.
Exactly. They have a duty to manage risk, implement security measures, and train their staff properly. The stakes are just too high to do anything less.
And for our lawyer listeners out there, this case really highlights the importance of understanding duty and foreseeability. especially when you're dealing with private organizations that play a role in public safety.
Couldn't agree more. It's a constantly evolving area of the law, and Dudley had a major impact on that evolution.
So stay informed, stay sharp, and always be thinking critically.
Great advice.
Well, that was quite a deep dive. We covered a lot of ground today. The tragic facts of the case, the court's reasoning, the impact on reentry programs, and legal strategy.
It's a case that really makes you think about the big questions.
It does. For anyone who wants to learn more, we encourage you to do your own research. Read the court opinions, explore the legal commentaries, and see how Dudley v. OAR is still shaping things today.
It's definitely a case worth revisiting.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us. We hope you found this deep dive insightful and maybe even a little bit thought-provoking. Until next time, keep those legal minds engaged.